Hi, I'm Patrick, and this is the second episode of Insurgent to Icon. I just want to say thank you for listening to the first one. The feedback I got was amazing, and I can't express that enough that it means a lot to me, seriously. I'm glad that some of you who reached out to me really enjoyed it, and I hope all of you did at some level. This second episode, we're mainly going to be dealing with... it's going to be a little dry at first, just bear with me. We're going to talk about kind of the lead-up of Michael Collins and how he kind of developed as a young adult, particularly in London, because he goes there. So the second part, you're going to like a lot more. It's more exciting. We're actually going to talk about the Easter Rising and the conflict in Dublin. So, again, sit back, relax, grab a glass of water, like I said last time, and just have a good time. Thank you so much, and I hope you enjoy this. So, if you remember where we left off, we were discussing the beginnings of a new idea of Irish nationalism, which we had stated is different in comparison to the older generations, primarily in regards to the idea of anti-Anglo sentiment. And what I mean by that is the idea of the British Empire has shifted in the consciousness of these young, new rebels, in that they believe firmly that Britain could be beaten in open battle. And that was largely due to events unfolding at the turn of the century, as I said, in South Africa with the Second Boer War. It'd be a case study which would actually prove this idea as a concrete, you know, belief. So a lot has changed since we last spoke about Collins and the world in the 19th century. Queen Victoria, Queen of the British Empire and Empress of India, had passed away in 1901, bringing to a close the Victorian era and beginning the Edwardian period, where her son Edward becomes king. Radio waves are now able to travel across the Atlantic Ocean, bringing the world closer together in the process. The Wright brothers have successfully taken their first flight, and the military alliance of the Entente Cordiale is formed between Great Britain and France following the first Moroccan crisis. And this crisis would see France and England essentially pivot against Germany, and it would set the tone for what's coming. Russia, similarly, is the victim of a humiliatingly crushing defeat against the newly industrialized power of Imperial Japan, causing the Russian people to rise in the ill-fated 1905 revolution, threatening the rule of the Tsar. And why that's important is because we're going to see, I might mention it later, the Germans are going to exploit that, because this revolution has empowered the Bolsheviks and socialists in Russia, and essentially it will set the stage for the rise of the USSR. So here we are now in the 20th century, and let's give her a go. So while we've stated Collins was born into this new age nationalism, his mother believed it would be best for him to avoid such radical ideologies. And to do so, his mother, Marianne O'Brien, pushed Michael Collins to take the British Civil Service exam in 1906 in Cork when he was just 15 years old. After passing this exam, Collins managed to secure a position abroad in London as a clerk at the Blythe House Post Office at the behest of his mother's wishes. This movement from colonialty was not the result of nationalism, as we've stated, but for Collins, it was to find a place in the world as an individual. Michael Collins would then be living with his sister, Hanny Collins, who had already established herself in London, where she too was employed as a clerk at a post office. And although the entire purpose of Collins being sent to London was to avoid the nationalistic rhetoric of home, that would fail, because Collins would be subjected to an actual stronger and more radical form there, and that would come in the form of the Gaelic League. But what is the Gaelic League, I hear you ask? Well, the Gaelic League was traditionally a cultural organization founded in 1893. It was geared towards the advancement and survival of Irish culture throughout the revival of the language, literature, song, and sport, the latter being the most popular with the young Michael Collins. Like, for example, when Collins was in London, his interest in the Gaelic culture peaked, as he reinvigorated his own Irishness abroad in London, discovering new Irish literary icons such as William Butler Yeats and Padraig Colum. Specifically, these two figures have been attributed with the breathing of new life into Irish literature within the 19th and early 20th century, and Yeats in particular became popularized during the Civil War period following the aftermath of the Great War, so he'll become a lot more popular later on. And in terms of sport, Collins was also a member of the Gaelic Athletic Association, which was an offshoot, or an athletic offshoot, of the Gaelic League. This sought to reinvigorate Gaelic sports such as Gaelic football and hurling. And like many other community-based amateur sporting leagues, it assisted in binding together a very distinct community. So these associations essentially assisted in the development of small colonies of Irish throughout British society. They would separate themselves from the local population, primarily based around traditional, familial, and associational ties to these cultural movements. And why is this important? Well, let's not forget the unique aspect of Irish nationalism, and that is the political aspect. And that political aspect would undoubtedly be the overarching theme of liberation, as Peter Hart, author of The IRA at War, would write, "Some activists, Michael Collins for one, graduated from apprenticeships in the Gaelic League. The usual networks of family, work, friendships helped him bind together as in Ireland. But what they had in common was a politicized sense of Irishness, and their activism was aimed at helping the movement in Ireland in any way possible." And we know already, coming from Ireland, that Michael Collins is a nationalist. But what's important about London is that his time here would help organize his ideals into concrete ideas, as these colonies helped instill the virtue of solidarity as an essential factor towards liberating Ireland. And this was the result of his time spent with the cultural and athletic associations, which in turn introduced him to the Irish colonies. These colonies would tell Collins essentially that Ireland could be set free if only the populace were to be truly united behind one purpose. In these associations, Collins saw everyday Irish join together, united in one cause centered around the anchor of Irish freedom. The Gaelic League essentially symbolized a unique Irish pride to Collins, yet its offshoot, the Gaelic Athletic Association in London, struggled in terms of membership and popularity throughout this period. And in order to keep the organization alive, there was the question of admitting English sports into the organization to find new members through the admittance of English football. This would have helped open up membership to other ethnic communities, in particular the English, which would have bolstered the failing membership of the organization. And from this issue, we see Michael Collins essentially transform the survival of the Athletic Association into a proxy war for the very survival of Irish culture. And he calls upon the very theme of unity as a means of Irish survival when he states, "If members are not prepared in the future to act more harmoniously together and more self-sacrificingly, generally, the club will soon have faded into the inglorious and well-deserved oblivion. It would appear the struggle to maintain the Gaelic Athletic Association ultimately mirrored the plight to maintain the cause of home rule to Collins, or rather, the survival of Irish culture itself." Collins, however, did not engage in ultra-nationalistic rhetoric. Rather, he was exposed to many facets of English culture as a means to reinforce the humanity which both parties shared. And this is largely due to his sister, Henny Collins, who acted independently in an attempt to fan the flames of his nationalism. To do so, she sought to introduce Michael Collins to many of her English friends, often bringing Collins to their homes and dinner tables. Henny was attempting to dislodge bigotry from Michael, which had infiltrated the rhetoric of Irish nationalism. And think of this bigotry as like an extension of the anti-Anglo sentiment, as there was a distinct motif to eliminate all that was English if Ireland was to regain her independence and native way of life. Henny had hoped that when the time came, Collins would understand his enemy in the literal sense, but also from a shared sense of humanity, that he would fight without hatred of the English people who he knew possessed other qualities than these. And that little excerpt there was from Edward O'Mahony's Michael Collins, His Life and Times. The Collins 22 Society online has some excellent resources and ebooks that I wholly advise that you read if you're interested in Collins or this time period at all. I've used it for, I guess, mainly my main arsenal for my paper. But again, yes, have a look at that stuff. It's really, really interesting. And another important takeaway that we can take from his time in London would be Collins' creation of friendship-based alliances. He became very popular throughout this community, and more importantly, it taught Collins to rely upon interpersonal alliances. Collins specifically espoused a childlike approach to loyalty, that friendships represented an irrevocable bond between individuals united in one cause. The aspect of interpersonal alliances would prove instrumental, as they were the beginnings of Collins' own cult of personality, which would assist him later on in life during the Civil War period. Yeah, I'm gonna hit you with an easy cop-out again, and I'm gonna say that's out of the scope of this episode. What we can and must take away, however, from this period in London would be his newly found ideal of unity, that through these associations and friendships, Collins became more invested in Irish communality than ever before. Collins now was witnessing an organized effort for the advancement of Irish freedom. Hope had been born. And through this reinvigorated voice of hope, the desire for home rule then represented the most attainable remedy to the national struggle. Victories were being won in the House of Commons. Importantly, Ireland's freedom now had been bound to the British system, that through cooperation with the British, Ireland could find freedom. And just before we continue talking about home rule, for those who don't know, Britain and the British Isles are a constitutional monarchy. They have two electoral bodies, the House of Commons and the House of Lords. I'm not going to explore them too much, but essentially the end game is royal assent. And royal assent is the method by which the monarch formally approves the act of legislate an act of legislature becoming law. So the bill must first go through the House of Commons, which is the lower house, and then the House of Lords, which is higher, and then finally it goes to the monarch to become law. That's just all I'm going to say. The Home Rule Bill, however, would experience a tumultuous existence. It would be constantly brought to the forefront of Anglo-Irish politics, securing victories in the House of Commons while simultaneously being killed in the House of Lords throughout the late 19th century and early 20th. To reiterate, the ratification of the Home Rule Bill would have been the enshrinement of Ireland as a dominion within the British Empire, granting the nation sovereignty over domestic affairs like the dominions of Canada and Australia. The controversial nature of this bill ranged from the plethora of social and political critiques on the sides of unionists in both England and Ireland. As previously mentioned, the Ulster Unionists were a significant opponent to the bill. In religious terms, they saw the creation of an Irish Parliament through a unique anti-Catholic lens, stating that home rule would essentially be Rome rule, that Parliament would be dominated by Catholics and, more importantly, by the Pope. And while indeed the religious aspect was influential enough that it could have itself stopped the bill, there was another important question that came from a lot of proponents of empire. So opponents of Home Rule believed that the bill represented the beginnings of the dismantlement of the British Empire, that by the ramification of such a bill, similar ones will undoubtedly follow throughout the rest of the British Empire, for other holdings, particularly most notably India, with a further fear for complete independence for Britain's overseas and established dominions such as Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. Essentially, this bill was viewed as outright treason by many proponents of the empire. As Michael F.J. McDonnell said, an axiom which is every day illustrated by English statesmen of either party when they say, on the one hand, that the refusal, and on the other hand, the concession of certain fiscal proposals will lead to the dismemberment of the empire. What can be stated in cold blood as a possible contingency in the case of, say, Canada or New Zealand has only to be a, oh, a big word, adumbrated, yes, and that of Ireland to be denounced, a treasonable aspiration to be put down with a strong hand. Home rule would only pass with compromise, and that would be through the partition of Ireland itself, with Ulster, Northern Ireland, remaining part of the United Kingdom. The bill finally received royal assent on September 18th, 1914. But if you're familiar with world history, 1914 is the beginning of World War I. And due to World War I and the Suspensory Act, Home Rule would be suspended for the duration of the conflict. All right, we're at the moment you've all been waiting for. We're going to start talking about something cool finally. 1916, World War I, and the Easter Rising. Are you excited? I'm excited. Okay, let's crack into this big egg. I don't like eggs, but let's crack into it. While we have learned that Collins did not play into the traditionally dark aspects of nationalistic rhetoric, nonetheless, he was still poised to end British rule in Ireland. And due to this, the IRB would appear to be an attractive group to individuals such as Michael Collins. And also, a couple days ago, I did some reading on Collins' father, and it turns out that he was actually a member of the IRB, meaning this organization has deeper roots in Collins' life than we have previously discussed. Just from what I gather and what I kind of did for my research of this paper, there was no definitive like make or break, yes, I'm joining the IRB kind of moment. What I'm gathering from this is it seems like Collins just kind of eased into this lifestyle. It's not like a dramatized event like we were probably thinking or hoping for. Anyways, though, the Irish Republican Brotherhood, or the IRB, reflected these ideals of the growing generation which Collins was brought up into, and that is the generation which believes in British weakness. In 1910, Collins joined the IRB through his connections within the Irish community in London. Collins quickly rose within the ranks of the IRB, becoming embedded within the strategic apparatus of the organization. In 1915, he and many other IRB members departed for Ireland to take part in what would become the Easter Rising. At this point, the British Empire and the Entente is waging a bloody industrialized war in the fields of France against the Central Powers. The First World War had entrapped the European powers into a fight to the death. The reality of the Great War had smashed the pro-war narratives which were rife throughout Europe before the beginning of the conflict, where a large number of Europeans were jovial in the initial declaration of hostilities, believing their respective nation will emerge victorious in a quick and decisive war. In fact, Imperial Germany in particular looked to Ireland as a green light for conflict, as at this time, Ulster Unionists were threatening to engage in open rebellion if in the event of Home Rule were to be passed, we can possibly deduce such a belief that Ulster would tie up the empire only came from the recent failures of South Africa. Yet the romanticism of a swift victory, glory, and the dream of European domination were cut short, as an entire generation found itself swept away in the mud and blood of the trenches, never to return. As we've stated, the outbreak of the Great War ultimately resulted in Parliament to suspend the Home Rule Bill, stating that following the end of the conflict, the bill shall come into effect. And we can attribute this to the beginnings of the war, or the wishful thinking of the era, that it would be a short conflict, in and out, 20-minute adventure. But we all know that wasn't the case. And I mean, it would be a 20-minute in and out adventure if you were in the Somme, where over 20,000 Commonwealth soldiers were killed in the battle's first hour. So yeah, pretty short for them. And the reason why casualties were so high is mainly due to an outdated means of thinking. I'm not a great military historian, but from what I do know about the Great War is that essentially in a post-Napoleonic thought dominated the higher echelons of command, and that was essentially like how they conducted the Prussian War, formations, line battles, the primacy of cavalry, and that's all outdated at this point when you have machine guns, grenades, improved rifling for snipers, and also howitzers. I mean, the new howitzers, right? And so what you have is you have like situations of men running literally right in the face of death for, I'd say, 5 miles and losing 6,000 men, something crazy like that. And they'll come back and they'll say, it's over, it's done. We took 5 meters and we lost 6,000 men. And the commander go, right, cool, blimey, mate. Let's do it again then with more men this time. You'll be getting a lot better, right? Simple. That's a very like simplistic way of outlining the Great War. Initially, at the start of the war, it was a war of motion. Men were moving these great maneuvers, but ultimately were being destroyed by machine guns. And what we learn from that, or what the soldiers would learn, is, hey, defenses work. We have to commit static warfare. We have to dig in. We have to prevent the enemy from advancing, and then we can counterattack when their attack is decimated. But the enemy isn't that stupid either, and they thought the same thing too. So what would happen is you'd make rows and rows and rows of trenches, other trenches covering the ones behind that, ones in front. And they stretched from Calais, from the English Channel, to Switzerland, and it became a war of attrition, essentially. Who can lose the most men, the most equipment, and how can the home front keep up? And if you can't keep up, you're done. That's game. Goodbye, you know? But yes, World War I is a war of attrition. It's brutal. It has never been seen before at this point, and no one is ready for it. I mean, that's not entirely true. Static warfare has been around for a while. But in the Victorian centuries, when we see the idea of trench warfare really take off, from what I remember, one of the first cases that comes to mind is the Mexican-American War, where the Americans would use trench networks to create artillery dugouts to, dig out or destroy Mexican fortifications. But we're kind of going off topic here. I'm going to go right back to what I was talking about right now. So, due to the great losses on the Western Front, the Empire was forced to enact conscription throughout the Empire, and most notably through Ireland. And that is important mainly that there's a higher troop presence throughout Dublin and in the rural countrysides as troops are training throughout Ireland for their initial deployment in the Western Front. Yet this increased British presence had a positive effect on the civilian population. Recruitment soared amongst Irishmen, while the IRB experienced a drastic decline in support. And while this is due to the increased amount of English troops and Irish troops now in Dublin, it is more so due to British propaganda. This propaganda mostly concerned with the German invasion of Catholic and neutral Belgium, whose occupied population was subsequently subjected to rampant atrocities carried out by German forces. These soldiers' actions were coined as the Rape of Belgium. And Entente propaganda exploited these crimes, denouncing the German enemy as barbaric, and for Ireland, the narrative of a fellow Catholic nation being attacked resounded with Irish Catholics throughout the nation. And regardless of those pro-war and pro-UK sentiments, the small IRB clique began to draft plans and to organize a rising, vowing to strike before the end of the war. So now I'm just going to go over some of the most prominent groups of the Rising. Firstly, we have the Irish Volunteers. The Irish Volunteers were a nationalist militia force which had been organized in 1913 in response to the creation of the Ulster Volunteers. The Irish Volunteers were organized primarily underneath the Gaelic League. But what's this I hear you say? Isn't the Gaelic League purely a cultural and sporting organization? Well, that was true, but by this time, the IRB had infiltrated the ranks of the Gaelic League. They had turned the organization into a recruitment platform. And this was primarily accomplished through the militarization of sport, and its subsequent primacy as a means to put potential soldiers into shape. In 1913, this organization was the strongest militia force in Ireland, yet by 1916, that had changed, as their membership before the war was estimatedly around 180,000 active members. And so why this happens, or why I'm saying the numbers were a lot larger before the war, is mainly due to a split in 1914. And this split was the decision to either assist or work against the British war effort, where many volunteers saw it necessary to defend Britain as a means to ensure the enactment of the Home Rule Act of 1914. And as I was saying, this is largely due to the Home Rule Bill being integrally part of the British parliamentary system. So by defending Britain, you're ensuring Ireland's freedom through the process that was already outlined and has been in the works for years now. And again, they saw this largely reliant on a British victory, that if the Entente lost, the future would be very uncertain. But what is certain, however, is if the Entente wins, the promise of a free Ireland or a Dominion of Ireland was ensured. Furthermore, there was a belief that the end of the conflict would ensure the freedom of small nations throughout Europe, as this conflict had originated in the defense of one, Serbia. I'm not going to explore this very much further, but what I've stated is the Irish Volunteers were the largest militia unit in Ireland, and this split resulted in the Volunteers being diminished woefully, as many of the Volunteers who were in favor of supporting Britain went overseas to fight alongside their counterparts, the Ulster Volunteers, in the fields of France. Those who remained or chose to boycott the British war effort numbered only around 15,000. So that's what I'm trying to say here. They are not as strong as they used to be, yet they are one of the most important ones. So now we're going to move on to another group now, and this is my personal favorite, and this is the Irish Citizen Army. Another rebel army, and one of my personal favorites, is the Irish Citizen Army. The Irish Citizen Army was a militia organization primarily composed of trade union volunteers from the Irish Transport and General Workers Union, or the ITGWU, who had formed in 1913 as a means to defend workers' safety during demonstrations from the Dublin Metropolitan Police, who during the Dublin lockout of 1913 killed four strikers alongside their strike-breaking company counterparts. Thousands more would be injured by police batons in ensuing riots, where seven more citizens would be later shot. James Connolly, the founder of the ICA, called for the formation of four battalions of trained men as a deterrent and weapon against unrestrained state violence against an undisciplined crowd. James Connolly also famously stated, "The cause of labor is the cause of Ireland," which tied together the cause of social liberation and the pursuit of national liberation to be one single dream. To conclude the ICA without going too much into workers' history, I'd love to do that, but that is not my field. The ICA is the Socialist Republican Militia composed of armed workers who fought for the freedom of Ireland, the freedom of the working class, and the freedom for women, as the ICA admitted women within their organization on equal terms to men. Another organization would be Fianna Éireann, or the Fianna of Ireland, meaning small independent warrior band. It was a nationalist youth organization founded in 1909. This organization was largely responsible for gun running operations prior to 1916, beginning in 1914. I'm not going to focus too much on this organization, as these fighters become important later during the Civil War, as many of these youth soldiers would grow up to become anti-treaty IRA members later in the 1920s. They're not so important right now, but they become the enemy of Michael Collins later, if that makes sense. However, what is important is the organization that they are affiliated with, which is Cumann na mBan. As Constance Markovitz, a founding member of Fianna Éireann, was similarly founder of Cumann na mBan, which meant the Women's Council. So Cumann na mBan was a women's paramilitary organization formed in 1914. And the reason why I'm talking about Cumann na mBan is because they were very, very influential fighters during the Rising itself. Many of their fighters have played numerous insurgent roles during the Rising, as these women acted as frontline soldiers, scouts, rooftop snipers, and spies in the midst of an urban combat zone. For example, some members of Cumann na mBan would volunteer for stretcher duty for the English, and due to this, they would be granted access behind enemy fortifications and access to English medical supplies and logistical information. So that kind of concludes our talk about the Irish rebel groups that are going to be taking part in the Rising. So what we're going to do now is we're going to start going back to the idea of weapons shipments and supplying the rebels. So if you remember last episode, I gave the idea that Ireland would attempt to gain weapons from Britain's enemy, the German Empire. As if you recall, the German Empire supplied Boer commandos in the Second Boer War, to the great dismay of the British. And as we were talking about earlier this episode as well, Germany knows what's going on in Ireland. Germany understands the destabilization that is taking place in both Ulster and throughout the Republic of Ireland, from what we know as the Republic of Ireland, but I mean the South. And they are more than happy to take advantage of this. Germany knows that the IRB does not possess the heavy weapons, such as machine guns, modern bolt-action rifles, and grenades to take on the British in open combat. And this is a viable military strategy employed by the German Empire during the Great War. And what I mean by viable military strategy is that this goal of destabilization and supporting rebels isn't necessarily to help them succeed. If they succeed, great, awesome. But the main goal is to distract the Entente powers and force them to take vital war material and manpower away from the front lines. In some cases, this wouldn't necessarily be taking materials and manpower away from the front, but more so putting more on the German front. For example, the German Empire would try and entice captured Indian POWs with promise of a free India if they were to fight for the German Empire. But there's also one more example of German destabilization, which is far more important in that it impacted world history for a whole century. And that would be none other than the creation of the Soviet Union. As the German Empire had sent Vladimir Lenin from exile back to Russia to go and incite a Bolshevik revolution, which succeeded in the creation of the USSR. And more importantly, Russia was out of the war, so that means Germany can focus all of their attention on the Western Front. And so for Ireland, the German Empire hoped to destabilize the British Empire further and decided to supply Irish insurgents using a captured English merchant vessel known as the SS Castro. The Castro would have been disguised as a Norwegian merchant ship and renamed the SS Libau. The German Empire hoped to carry cargo containing captured Russian Mosin Nagant rifles from the recent Russian defeat at Tannenberg to Irish insurgents. But that was basically it, as Germany had not intended to send Ireland any serious heavy weapons or modern Mausers at all, as everything was needed for their own front line against the Entente on the Western Front. However, this arms deal would fail, as the SS Libau would be intercepted by three British destroyers on Good Friday, the 21st of April, and to add insult to injury, the boat was scuttled to prevent the British from capturing its cargo. To just conclude this, the Germans had relatively failed in allowing an organized transfer of arms to Irish insurgents. Therefore, Irish revolutionaries were forced to use captured British Lee Enfield rifles, Webley revolvers, shotguns, and in some cases the use of outdated single-shot rifles dating from the Franco-Prussian War from 1870. And furthermore, the capture of this vessel put pressure on the rebels to act, as it appeared now the British were onto them, and their plans for an organized rising were now in jeopardy. On April 24th, 1916, Easter Monday, rebels belonging to the Irish Volunteers, the Irish Citizen Army, Comhain na mBan, and other IRB affiliates conducted a typical parade maneuver within the city of Dublin. These groups would typically parade throughout Dublin with broomsticks and just regular sticks as a means to create public face and to, in a sense, intimidate the British occupation. However, this parade was different, as they were armed. The purpose then of this mock parade was meant to allow militia groups to quickly seize strategic structures throughout the city, the key structure being Dublin Castle, the nerve center of the British administration in London. As rebels marched to the entrance of Dublin Castle, they were approached by an unarmed sentry, Officer James O'Brien, who attempted to dissuade the rebels from carrying out the rising. He would be shot dead, being the first casualty of the rising. Following the first shot, the British sentry at the Dublin Castle would break from the guards room and open fire on the rebels. Rebels initially panicked and quickly routed a building surrounding the castle. Little did they know, though, that Dublin Castle is woefully unmanned and could have easily been stormed by the rebels, who were numerically superior. This failure would be crucial in that it would allow the British to make calls for reinforcements to the British High Command in England. Michael Collins himself took part in seizing one of the most important buildings, being one of the soldiers taking part in the capturing of the General Post Office, or the GPO. The office was seized with little to no resistance, employees and British agents were taken prisoner. And following this capture, Irish rebel leader and key organizer of the rising, Patrick Pearse, read aloud on the steps of the GPO to the Irish populace the proclamation of an independent Irish Republic. This moment is widely regarded as the foundation for the modern Irish state. The GPO would quickly transform into the nerve center for the Irish rebels, where Pearse and other rebel commanders would dictate the course of the battle, through the use of runners who would relay information from command to the front in a dangerous urban environment. On the first day, the British response was lackluster, one of the first responses being a squad of British Lancers. These cavalrymen believed that their sheer presence would coerce the rebels to flee in terror, and they rode in formation down Sackville Street. Once spotted by the rebels, however, they were subjected to accurate rifle fire, which left three of their men dead, forcing the cavalry unit to rout. The first and second days passed without much excitement, as looting filled the streets of Dublin. Much of Dublin's garrison was, in a sense, besieged by the rebels. They could not move or leave their positions in any shape or form. However, this was not to last, as fighting erupted near St. Stephen's Green. It is within these opening hours of the conflict that these two monumental figures of the Irish Civil War would emerge. Michael Collins and Eamon de Valera would distinguish themselves as confident leaders during the Easter Rising. Importantly, the Rising provided each individual with perspectives which would ultimately result in the later splitting of the Revolutionary Assembly of Ireland, the Dáil Éireann, which would mark the beginning of the Irish Civil War. Now, for my paper and my thesis on why Collins changes, this event is the defining moment which will set these two figures apart and, more importantly, force Collins to adopt a more pragmatic outlook on Irish independence. My main argument being that both Collins and de Valera participated in the Rising under completely different circumstances, which would ultimately provide each man with their own unique experience of the Rising. Now I'm going to introduce Eamon de Valera a little bit more properly here, as we haven't touched upon him or who he is at all. I won't be going deep into his character, primarily for time restraints, but I hope I can give you a strong enough introduction to have a general idea of this figure. Eamon de Valera is an American-born Irishman, born October 14, 1882, from an Irish mother and Spanish father. However, his father would die when he was only two, prompting de Valera to be taken to Ireland by his uncle, as his mother could no longer financially support him at home. In Ireland, de Valera would go on to become a teacher of mathematics at Ceresfort Teachers Training College for Women. In 1908, he would join the Gaelic League, becoming an activist for the Irish language. And de Valera would ultimately be radicalized through the formation of the Ulster Volunteers, being one of the first members to join the Irish Volunteers in 1913, where he took part in numerous successful gunrunning operations. De Valera would quickly rise to the ranks, and was appointed an executive position within the Irish Republican Brotherhood, becoming a commandant during the Easter Rising. During the Easter Rising, Eamon de Valera found himself caught in a war of mobility, constantly moving back and forth between fighting positions and his headquarters. Due to his own impressive military record, as well as his own seniority within the IRB, de Valera exercised greater autonomy during the Rising. His experience is widely regarded as one of the most successful military endeavors of the Easter Rising, as he was responsible for inflicting terrible losses upon the British forces while sustaining minimal casualties himself. The most famous engagement underneath de Valera's command was the Battle of Mount Street Bridge, where de Valera and his 17 men successfully defended their position against an entire British battalion, which is around 1,000 soldiers, inflicting heavy casualties onto the British. And this is largely due to the battle taking place on a bridge, where there's only one pathway the British can go, and that's right across it. So what de Valera essentially did is he garrisoned the buildings right across the bridge and just opened fire on the British troops who were coming right across. It was a turkey shoot. There was no cover for them, essentially. And this would have been largely made worse due to the prevailing military theories of the time. And that would be to just keep going, more men next time, we'll overrun them. And that was largely responsible for the loss of life on the British behalf. In total, the British assault suffered approximately 234 casualties, resulting in the most successful defense of the day. Furthermore, de Valera was spared the might of the British Royal Artillery, as he was able to masquerade a disused distillery as his headquarters, resulting in the British forces constantly shelling at the empty structure while his men fought on. However, de Valera's actions are not universally accepted as the most successful resistance during the Rising. His command was viewed as one of indecisiveness. Essentially, de Valera constantly organized assaults, only to cancel them in the final minutes, and would summarily fail to commit to several key defensive actions, such as the crucial operation at Mount Street Bridge. While the position proved to be nearly impenetrable to the British, the rebels quickly ran out of ammunition, which de Valera failed to replenish, which would force many of its defenders to abandon their positions. Rather, it would be the bravery and ingenuity of his men who were truly responsible for the general success of de Valera's defensive sectors. As T. Ryle Dwyer writes in Big Fellow Longfellow, a joint biography of Collins and de Valera, he carefully prepared what appeared to be important operations, but then would suddenly cancel them. A striking feature of all the accounts of his part in the rebellion is the paucity of detail about what he actually did other than run around and change his mind. He never made any serious attempt to help or relieve the men. And this isn't really due to his character more so than the situation. As De Valera succumbed to sleep deprivation as he refused to sleep during the rising. On one occasion where his men begged him to sleep, he would state, "I can't trust the men," he said. "They'll leave their posts or fall asleep if I don't watch." However, the success of De Valera's defensive sector appears to be a validifying factor in regards to the nationalist belief the British were not invincible. From these accounts, it is apparent that De Valera maintained a relative distance from the actual combat, maintaining purely leadership role rather than that of a combat role. So on the third day of the rising, the tide shifts. Rebels throughout the city are running out of food, weapons, and ammunition, and that even goes for civilians who are now turning to street looting and are being subjected to sniper fire, machine gun fire on behalf of both the rebels and the British. And more importantly, on the third day, British reinforcements finally arrive at 6:20 a.m. These troops are originally destined for France and are confused of why they're in Dublin. And at 8 a.m., the gunboat Helga begins moving into Dublin and opening fire at the Liberty Hall. Due to this massive amount of artillery and troop presence, the rebels are forced to abandon several key positions. Many other rebels choose instead to surrender. Yeah, I didn't clarify this exactly. The third day is when the Battle of Mount Street Bridge happens, where De Valera wins the most successful engagement of the Rising against the British. Sackville Street, where we originally saw the cavalrymen ride down, is now engulfed in flames as machine guns and artillery is pounding across the other side of the river. Almost all shops and homes in this area are currently on fire. It is also at this point that many of the rebels who are retreating begin to do a staggered retreat. And what that means is they're going to set up ambush points or a little smaller localized defense platforms to stop the British from advancing in totality to more key locations such as the GPO. So at this point, you see small little holdouts of rebels carrying out little ambushes against British troops who are running freely through the streets at this point. And as darkness falls on the third day, snipers rule the night. Yet that does not stop the British from creating several defensive positions. And these are slit trenches. They're just very rudimentary foxholes. They're very thin little rectangles and you're just meant to lay in them and open fire. They're not too deep. They also use several barrels to create like defensive walls where men can shoot in between the barrels. And a lot of these defensive structures are erected around like centers of command. Like for example, the GPO had a lot of defensive areas where the British could set up in front and shell the building from a safe distance. But more importantly, these defensive locations are meant to stop the rebels from leaving their positions. Michael Collins' account truly differs. Collins did not have the high command role that De Valera had and would relatively be subjected to creating the barricades and defenses in and around the GPO at the start of the Rising. And as a result, Collins' experience diverges from De Valera's. Firstly, the British gunboat Helga began to shell the GPO with accurate cannon fire, blanketing the nerve center of the rebellion in accurate artillery fire for the majority of the day, inflicting serious losses upon its garrison. British ground forces were also successful in its setting up a siege position around the GPO, suppressing its defenders with accurate machine gun fire and sniper fire, later to be assisted with support artillery on the ground. The scene at the GPO was a far cry from the inspiring scene at Mount Street Bridge. As Tim Pat Coogan stated, "The gunboat Helga came up the Liffey, and its shelling, combined with sustained machine gun fire and rifle fire, had Sackville Street in flames by Friday, the GPO being the epicenter of the Holocaust." And so what I'm trying to say here is De Valera's account differs mainly in that he created a dummy HQ, which would receive a lot of the British artillery, whereas with Collins and Pierce and all the other rebels, the GPO is not that hard to miss. A more important point to be made, however, would be the relationship between Collins and his comrades. As recently stated, Collins had a unique relationship between himself and his friends within the Irish population in London. Many of these friends followed Collins into the GPO, who fought and died alongside Collins, becoming a key factor behind Collins' later surrender. Again, due to Collins' rank and central position in the GPO and the presence of static emplacements, Collins did not possess the room for maneuverability as De Valera had. Collins and his men were cornered. As the situation within the GPO deteriorated further when the flames engulfed the building, it became apparent that the makeshift parliament would not be held. Collins called for a hasty retreat, but his men did not make it that very far.
they found themselves cornered once again, with no possible escape route. Many frantically wanted to fight on, but Collins did not embrace the rhetoric of becoming martyrs for the revolution. Rather, he believed that he and his small contingent would be able to sacrifice themselves to save most of the men. He solemnly stated to his men, "We'll die, you'll escape, no one will try to conscript you." His men, however, chose to lay down their arms in unison. The Easter Rising for Collins was a darker experience, where he witnessed the full might of the British military, which eviscerated the rebellion, gutting Dublin and its inhabitants in the process. The aftermath of the Rising destabilized Collins. The pre-1916 Collins was enthralled by the ideals of a Republican movement, but post-1916 he was broken, as his friends and countrymen were strewn about the streets of Dublin in a horrifying scene. From Tim Pat Coogan, Michael Collins, The Man Who Made Ireland, it's written, "Michael Collins sat in the corner, a look of horror in his eyes, a pallor spreading over his face. Disjointed words told Harding that O'Reilly's eviscerated corpse and the riddled civilians in the blood-clogged cobbles had come to life in one man's imagination, straining his control to a breaking point." Many of these casualties were Collins' close friends from London and from his childhood in Cork. Collins and his men surrendered to save themselves, to preserve the desire to fight another day, to keep the dream of a free Ireland alive. Eamon D. Valera, on the other hand, only surrendered once being ordered to by his superiors after the signing of the ceasefire. It is important to note that D. Valera's resistance mostly stemmed from frontline propaganda of the Great War. Fearing for his soldiers' lives due to reports that British soldiers were killing prisoners of war in France. From this, D. Valera feared that if he and his men surrendered to the British, they would be met with a similar fate. On Saturday, the 29th of April, Pierce surrendered to the British forces. Now that the Rising was over, it was clear that the main casualties were civilians. Around 260 civilians were caught in the crossfire and were killed. A good portion of these deaths are mostly attributed to British artillery and the use of incendiary rounds inside of an urban environment to dislodge the rebels. And that was largely due to, in part, of the British were unable to discern civilians from rebels at this point. As one Royal Irish Regiment officer said, "They regarded, not unreasonably, everyone they saw was an enemy and fired at everything that moved." Both sides would actually shoot civilians on occasion deliberately, as looting was running rampant throughout the entire city, and through cases of assault or just not following orders, civilians would often be shot by both British and rebel soldiers. There were also two significant massacres carried out by British soldiers on North King Street and the Portobello Barracks. Following the Rising, Eamon D. Valera resented his surrender, believing that the blood of the martyrs would eventually bring about the creation of an Irish Republic, which had been read aloud on the steps of the GPO when the Rising began, as the proclamation itself had stressed the necessity of sacrifice, that only through the commitment of human life would the Republic be protected. As it was written in the proclamation, "We pledge our lives and the lives of our comrades in arms to the cause of freedom, of its welfare, and of our exaltation among other nations." Essentially, Eamon D. Valera believed that if more had been sacrificed, if Moore had committed to the rebellion, the Republic would have survived. As noted by T. Ryle Dwyer, they believed their ultimate goals would be realized by others in the long run. If they made a blood sacrifice at this time, they were right. But D. Valera would only realize this later. He was one of those who had believed the rebellion might actually succeed in establishing an independent Irish Republic right then and there. Collins, on the other hand, handled defeat more bitterly. The Rising had appeared to Collins as not only a disastrous affair, not only from a military standpoint, but more importantly, from the creation of an Irish Republic. As not only had the Rising failed, it had primarily damaged the relationship between the Irish people and the Republicans. As it would appear, the inheritors of an Irish Republic were very hostile towards the rebels after they surrendered. And this is largely due to two factors. The first being the one that we said earlier, that a lot of Dublin is actually in support of the British in the war effort. And that ultimately a maneuver to, try and oust the British forcefully would be seen as an action against Ireland. And secondly, civilians were the largest casualty group of this battle. About 54% of the deaths were civilians. So essentially, this destruction would have been the rebels' fault in the civilians' eyes. The power of the British artillery and the British army was brought down upon them for their single instance of rebellion. The Rising had resulted in the rebels becoming the antagonists of Ireland. As T. Ryle Dwyer writes again, "The rebels were pelted with rotten fruit and vegetables by Dublin people, who blamed them for the week's destruction, in which more innocent civilians perished than combatants on either side. 262 civilians were reported killed." Collins and many other rebels who were identified as low in rank and not crucial to the rebel hierarchy were to be transported across the Irish Sea, to be imprisoned in English internment camps. For high-ranking rebel officers and organizers such as Eamon de Valera, they would be imprisoned in Kilmingole, whereupon many of them would be executed without trial. Eamon de Valera is not executed, just a little pinning right there. We're going to cover that next episode. However, these killings sparked outrage amongst the Irish population. These killings would lead to outrage amongst the general population, sympathetic Catholic clergy members, and surviving nationalists, as the news of these authoritarian executions would quickly lead to rumors of British atrocities spreading throughout the nation. The extrajudicial executions slowly shifted public support from antagonizing the rebels to ultimately recognizing the fallen as heroes for Ireland. And in some scenarios, this exchanged the desire for home rule for outright independence. So when I said Collins held the defeat more bitterly, what I really meant to say is that he handled defeat in a more cynical manner. And the point of this is mainly being that Collins is a different person, and more importantly, Collins values pragmatism or cynicism, in a sense, as a core value to his character. As there were no what-ifs, as de Valera expressed, an example of this arises with Dwyer, once again, when Dwyer provides an example of Collins being carried out of Dublin with other prisoners. Dwyer writes, "Well, it was a good fight, Mick," a colleague said as they were going down the quays. "What do you mean, good fight?" he snapped in reply. "We lost, didn't we?" Why this is important is that Collins had appeared to be more cynical of the results, as opposed to de Valera, who believed that the rising could have succeeded if more just died or if the civilians joined in. To Collins, history had repeated itself. They had lost. Nothing could have changed that. And just to conclude about the rising, as I said, it's often referred to as the foundations of the modern Irish state that currently exists, and that is largely due to, in part, to the aftermath. And what I mean by that is that at this point, after the rising, public opinion shifts. There's been a growing sense of, I guess, outrage at the British reaction to the rising in both their conduct and their shelling and how they handled the prisoners. That was the straw that broke the camel's back in that scenario. But what the Rising had done is it immortalized these figures, these martyrs of revolution, and therefore martyrs of Ireland. More importantly, this is the beginning of the Irish Revolutionary War period, as the men who are now in prison in England will come back and they will continue the fight. And even more so, the people who are executed and killed, it leaves a large power vacuum within the Irish revolutionary system. And that will allow figures such as Eamon de Valera, who survives, and I'll get to that, don't worry, and Michael Collins to rise to prominence, as I've said before. I just want to clarify and get this in a nice little ball so you can understand what happened and why this is important. In our next episode, we will be attempting to tackle the Irish War of Independence, a war of espionage, guerrilla strikes, and brutal military oppression, a conflict which would see both Eamon de Valera and Michael Collins rise to power, as well as the beginnings of the IRA, which set the stage for the coming Civil War of the 1920s. So yeah, that concludes our second episode. Personally, if I can be a little bit honest here, I feel like I haven't done such a good job with this in particular. I wanted to explore more of the rising and of combat, and also I wanted to get this episode out on time, but I didn't do that. Initially, I wanted to release this last week, but just for a lot of reasons, and stupid ones at that, I didn't do that, and I really procrastinated and put it off. And on top of that, my research in terms of the rising itself was pretty weak. I wanted to talk about actual combat, the strategies employed, but I also was in a slight like inner conflict with that because I want to pertain to Michael Collins and focus on that, as I did with my paper. And I just kind of feel like I've let myself down and you guys, in a sense. So if you're on the Anchor platform, I'll be attaching a message link. And if you want to add any information or something that you found interesting about the rising or a comment on something I said or just the podcast in general, feel free to access that and you can send a little voice message. And I'd very much appreciate that. And I would love to hear from you guys. Also, just feedback and any general information about my podcast or stuff I'm doing or even just about my education, I would be more than happy to answer and hear what you have to say. So, yes. But anyways, I want to just thank you again from the bottom of my heart just for even taking the time to listen to this, and I hope you had a good time listening at that.
I'm going to try and get this out faster. And if it's possible, I think I'm going to stick to this rhythm of the 1 week where I work on it, and then 1 week in the middle to refine, like do script work, and then the second week I'll record it and get it out. Also, I have other big news too for my own personal life. I have been accepted into a master's program for history at Arizona State University, so yay me. But yeah, sorry, I'm going to wrap this up. Thank you for listening. It means the world. I hope you're all having a safe and fun time out there wherever you are. And yes, thank you. Seriously, thank you so much. And I can't wait to hear from you. See you next time. Bye-bye. And I just noticed while I was editing this that I cannot add a link to the podcast. Kind of stupid of me. Instead, I've made an Instagram account for this podcast. It's called Gedco Podcast. So GEDCO Podcasts. And I will have the link for that on there. It's on Instagram. And as always, again, thank you so much for listening. And I hope you have a good time. And one more thing. I'm going to be playing a song here pretty soon. And if you'll only hear it if you're on the Anchor app, however. And it's The Foggy Dew by the Dubliners. And this song is about the Easter Rising of 1916. So I hope you enjoy it. Please take care. And thank you for listening again. Thank you.